It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
That was President Roosevelt in 1941, the day after Pearl Harbor, 75 years ago today. Remember that the war had already broken out in Europe. The Nazis were marching through, taking territory, so the world was already, you know, tense. But Japan was not part of the World War yet. They had allied with the Nazis. I'm not sure if they had at this point yet. Maybe they did after the attack. We'll ask our next guest in a second. But, of course, the world was nervous, but America was not in the war. That was a war of Europe. They had already had a World War One, and America didn't want to be part of another war. They'd had it. Europeans didn't want to be part of another war either, another world war, but they were drawn into it by the aggression of the Nazis. So they're fighting the war. Winston Churchill, desperately, you know, every night London is facing these blitzkrieg attacks, and London is being decimated, and England is really the only country that's standing up. France folded, and, you know, the Dutch had a strong underground, but they didn't have the strength to fight back. And so the Nazis were overtaking Europe. So here comes, we're all watching Europe, and then suddenly, on December 7th of 1941 and 7:48 in the morning, the Japanese pretty much decimated the American fleet. And to put it in context, there were 2,403 Americans killed, 1,178 wounded. It was like it was their 9/11. The difference is that it pulled America into a war that would last, you know, until 1945. Husbands, fathers, brothers would enlist. You know, certainly the war in the Pacific was a terrible war in terms of the treatment by the Japanese, because they did not have any kind of, they didn't have Judeo-Western values about treatment of prisoners. There was no gentleman's honor. Even with the Nazis, there was some sort of honor among prisoners, but nothing like that with the Japanese. So this brought us into not just an attack where people, thousands of people were killed, but it also changed the lives, changed the direction, and caused the future deaths of thousands and thousands of U.S. Americans in a fight for our national life. Well, I can't think of anyone better to talk about this today than our next guest. It's actually a real privilege and an honor to have him join us. And let me just tell you about him for a second. He was an officer of the U.S. Navy for 36 years, but he served as the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, which, of course, is the largest single military command in the world. He also served as a senior U.S. military representative to the United Nations. And as the deputy chief of naval operations from 1983 to 1985, he was the principal advisor on all Joint Chiefs of Staff matters and was the father of the Navy Red Seal, an anti-terrorism group comprised of Navy SEALs. Admiral James Lyons was also commander of the U.S. Second Fleet and commander of the NATO Striking Fleet, which were the principal fleets for the implementing of the Navy's maritime strategy. Admiral James Ace Lyons, born in 1927, is 89 years old right now. He still speaks, lectures. He heads a group called the Lyon Associates. He's the CEO of that. And I am really honored that he should join us this morning. Good morning, Admiral Lyons.
Well, good morning to you and your listeners.
You know, I have to ask you, why did they call you Ace?
Well, I got that playing from my football days at Navy.
All right. Well, that's a that's a small thing to you today, but it's actually a very big thing. Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was in my parents' car. We were riding, as people did in those days, to a Sunday dinner in Red Bank, New Jersey, at the Molly Pitcher Hotel. I remember it as clear as if it was yesterday.
Now, of course, you were a young teenager. Did you hear it on the radio? Or
on the car radio.
Oh. All right, so if you, looking back in time, this is an obvious question. Still, if you were to term what a change it made in your own personal life, were you planning on going into the Navy? Were your family Navy careerists? Did that have any impact on you at all?
Well, I was going to, I was always going to be a marine engineer. My family was in the steamship business. So I was always oriented towards the sea. So, you know, my migration into the Navy was not that difficult.
I'm curious about one thing. I wondered, as I was reading this morning and pondering, I need to say, Admiral Lyons, my own father was, he was 21 when this happened, and he had, and this is the reason why he ended up going into the military. I think in December, just past Pearl Harbor Day, he joined and he joined the Army and you know, spent his time in France and England. But this changed so many different lives, and of course it has affected my life because of the trajectory of my own father serving in the war. But I'm curious to know, you know, the war was raging, we should say, in Europe. Why did we have such a strong fleet in the Pacific? Were we anticipating something with Japan?
Well, the main purpose, the decision was made to position the Pacific Fleet in Hawaii as a deterrent force. The thinking was at that time, with such a strong display of our capability there, the Japanese would look elsewhere to attack. And what your listeners need to know is, you know, we did have advance notice that an attack was going to occur. It certainly had all the symptoms. And it really goes back, it's starting in August of 1941. The Japanese became fascinated by the British attack on the Italian naval base at Taranto, which had a similar shallow water depth, similar to Pearl Harbor. And the British were able to go in and conduct a very successful attack using torpedoes and in shallow water. Well, this fascinated the Japanese, and actually the British were very successful. They essentially destroyed the Italian Mediterranean fleet. So there was a double agent by the name of Popov, And the Japanese sent a series of questions to the Germans. Popov was actually a British agent and the working with some of the high-level Germans. The Germans gave Popov questions. Popov was then sent by the Brits to America. He met with the FBI in August of 41. He gave them the questions. The questions then were paraphrased in such a way, were then turned over to military intelligence. And for some reason, it did not raise the level of awareness that it should have. Because the conventional thinking at the time was there was no way a torpedo attack could be conducted at Pearl Harbor since there was no such capability. That was the conventional thinking at the time. Secondly, we had also broken, following that event, the Japanese diplomatic code, PURPLE, and it was referred to as MAGIC. So we were reading, there were 10 people in Washington who were cleared to receive this sensitive intelligence information. And that was the president, the secretary of state, Cordell Hull, the secretary of war, Stimson, General Marshall, Admiral Stark, who was the chief of naval operations, Richmond Kelly Turner, the head of Navy war plans, and the head of Army war plans, and the heads of the two Army and Navy military intelligence organizations. Those were the only people authorized to receive this information. The purple machines were reproduced. Two were sent to Churchill in England for his use. The Army had two, the Navy had two, and one was sent to MacArthur in the Far East for his use. However, none were sent to Admiral Kimmel or Lieutenant General Short in Hawaii. Amazing.
All right, so now let's go back, Admiral Lyons, because you've said so much. And, you know, before we even talk further, let me just say that you have a great article that was just published in the Washington Times, Pearl Harbor, 75 Years On, and in which he discusses this. You know, there's been so much mystery. By the way, we're going to put this on our Facebook page. There's been so much mystery about why we didn't know, and that's what you're talking about, and you are revealing things I've certainly never heard in this article that you wrote. Let's go back just a second, because you mentioned this British double agent, Dusko Popov, and you said he was the prototype for James Fleming's James Bond. I think that's really fascinating, first of all. And he was the one who carried the questions that the Japanese sent, asking questions about how Great Britain conducted their surprise attack on Toronto. I guess they wanted to know how they did it. The questions were that. What did you do? How did you do it? Is that what the questions were?
Exactly. And, you know, how did they modify the torpedoes for the shallow water?
Okay.
And they wanted all of this applied to, they wanted the same type of information on Pearl Harbor. And they were very explicit.
All right,
and they had other questions that related to other areas.
Okay.
They, you know, as far as how many planes were on the airfield. And mixed up in all of this is how many... What was our production capability?
All right.
And what torpedo nets
Admiral Lyons,
used?
We have to take we have to take a commercial break. But when we come back, let's pick up with that, because Popov was given this information. He actually then handed it, because he was a double agent, over to the Americans. You've already said this, but let's go back and flesh it out a little bit, because this is a fascinating story. My guest is Admiral James Lyons, the former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. And we'll be right back on the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
We are going to the Holy Land in March. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. I only lead one tour a year. to Israel. It's not my day job. It's just an annual tour that I do as I learn from my dad how to take folks to Israel. And we're going to have a wonderful experience. Most of the folks going are listeners to American Family Radio, are supporters of American Family Association. And we're going to have a great time March 9th through the 17th. If you want information on this tour of the Holy Land, you can do it two ways. You can call us at 800-FAMILIES, option 5. 1-800-FAMILIES, option 5. That's families with an S. And leave us your name and your address, and we'll put a brochure in the mail to you. And if you want to go online, you can visit us at twholyland.com. twholyland.com. Again, won't be long till we close out this tour, so if you want more information, let us know. Your American Family Association will never quit.
We will never quit, ever.
We will continue to stand for God's truth as long as we have breath and the religious liberty to do so.
We believe that God might still show mercy to America by sending revival.
So, we will continue to be salt and light in our nation.
Thank you for standing with the American Family Association this year through your prayers, your financial partnership, and your determination to be salt and light where you live. In the days ahead, we ask for your continued involvement so that as battles arise, your American Family Association will be here to fight for your family, fight for America.
Let me tell you something. All God asks of you is faithfulness. That's it.
Today, when you give $35 or more, we'll send you the new book, Our Call to Faithfulness, The Voice and Legacy of Don Wildman. Visit afa.net/faithfulness.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with this Fox News and Commentary next. Truett McConnell University is training students to love the Lord, love the Word, love the Church, and love the lost. Scripture is the foundation for everything they do. It's who they are, preparing students not just for a career, but to fulfill God's high calling on their lives. Truett McConnell University offers a wide array of bachelor's programs, some online, and they also have an outstanding Master of Arts in Theology. So if you'd like to schedule a visit to Truett's campus in the North Georgia Mountains, visit truett.edu. A bunch of perpetually offended atheist agnostics and free thinkers just got a lump of coal in their Christmas stockings. A local radio station has pulled the Freedom From Religion Foundation radio show off the air. Radio station WIBA in Madison, Wisconsin, canceled Free Thought Radio and replaced the show with around-the-clock Christmas music. Well, if that doesn't curdle an atheist eggnog, I don't know what will. The Freedom From Religion Foundation, not big fans of the baby Jesus. They make their living by filing lawsuits against towns who display nativity scenes and Christmas trees. Basically, a bunch of godless Grinches. But apparently, progressive talk does not make for good radio. So the station opted to play Jingle Bells. That means the Freedom From Religion Foundation has been silenced in Madison, Wisconsin. Christmas really is the most wonderful time of year. I'm Todd Starnes.
Merry Christmas from American Family Radio and Sandy Rios in the Morning.
December 7th, 1941. No American will ever forget this Sunday morning in Hawaii. Across the blue waters of Pearl Harbor, the Pacific Fleet rides serenely at anchor. There is peace and quiet in Honolulu. There is a hope for peace in the hearts of all Americans. There is a forceful plea for peace in the words of the President of the United States. But his last message to Japan's Emperor falls on deaf ears. Grim silence is the reply. No outward sign reveals what may be the nature of the Mikado's answer. In Washington, Secretary of State Hull continues peace negotiations with Jap Ambassador Nomura and Special Envoy Kurusu, not knowing that genial smiles mask murder in their hearts. Hawaii's bright Sunday becomes a black Sunday. High overhead, Jap raiders are on the loose. Without warning, they circle Pearl Harbor and the city of Honolulu, a surprise attack born of infamy. Sirens screech the alarm too late. Already the yellow men have unloosed their bombs. Planes sweep the Waikiki district. The sky sky rains death and destruction. Caught unawares on this fateful Sunday morning, Americans quickly and calmly evacuate the danger districts.
This was Pearl Harbor, America's prime naval base in the Hawaiian Islands. 19 proud ships rested on the bottom. 4,572 men were dead, wounded, or missing. In the hands of Japan rested the balance of power in the Pacific. Bought at a known cost of 48 planes shot down, 3 midget submarines, perhaps 150 men.
Pickham failed. In all, 97 Army planes were destroyed, according to the figures in the plain spoken disclosure given by the United States government to the American people about the facts of Pearl Harbor. This is the record of what President Roosevelt has called the day that will live in infamy.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. No, those are the days, you know, you used to go to the movies and you would actually see those newsreels. You would see them before you'd watch the movie. And that's, you know, because you didn't have, not everyone had television. Plus, those newsreels were always pro-American. It was always about, you know, the country and loving it. And so Americans were united. It was amazing. You know, I think the thing about war is that it often brings clarity, moral clarity. And that's what you hear. They talk about, you know, they're shaking hands with the ambassador of Japan, but he has murder in his heart. That's what the man says. That's really true. But we can't say those things now. We're talking about that attack. How is it that Franklin Delano Roosevelt didn't know anything? How is it that Winston Churchill didn't seem to know anything? How is it that the commanders in the Pacific didn't know anything about this? Because there certainly were signs. Well, a new article written by our guest is called Pearl Harbor, 75 Years Old. It's in the Washington Times. We're going to put it on our Facebook page. And it tells a very fascinating story. Admiral Ace Lyons is my guest. He is the former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, among many, many other accolades. He was in the Navy as an officer for 36 years. He was 14 when Pearl Harbor took place. And he joins us this morning. We were just talking about this British double agent, Dusko Popov, who delivered questions the Japanese had prepared about a successful surprise attack Britain had done on Toronto, asking all kinds of questions about what kind of bombs they used, how they did it. They gave it to this Dusko Popov, not knowing he was a double agent. Dusko Popov takes this off to a Washington, D.C., and hands it over, a court, allegedly, to the FBI. So, Admiral Lyons, that, you know, what do we know about what J. Edgar Hoover might have done with those questions?
Well, we know that he did paraphrase the questions and did send them to both the Army and Navy military intelligence organization. And for some reason, they did not, they failed to recognize the key significance. They were mixed in with a bunch of other questions as well. But regretfully, it didn't raise the interest and the level that it should have. And, of course, the way things were being handled then, you know, information was power. And none of that information really was shared across the board with anybody, certainly not with the commanders in Hawaii. They were totally blacked out from any of that type of information, including the intercepts we were making on PURPL, the diplomatic code the Japanese were using that we broke. And none of that information was passed to those two commanders.
Well, I want to talk about more about that purple intelligence that you've referred to, because I have a lot of questions about that. But let me just interject that you point out that Admiral Husband Kimmel, the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, and Lieutenant General Walter Short, who was responsible for the defense of Hawaii, were both blamed, that their names have been sullied now in the ensuing 75 years. And you don't think that you think that needs to be set right?
Correct.
All right, so because, as you just said, they never received, they didn't see these questions. And then, of course, we talk about the purple intelligence, and that was, we understood all that the Japanese were communicating because we had decoded their intelligence. Who did that? You know, who did, was that the British or the Americans who did that?
Well, both. We broke it, and at some point the Brits broke it as well. In fact, we provided to Churchill two or three of the purple machines to facilitate the further decoding of the Japanese diplomatic codes.
All right, so these purple machines, there were just a select few of them. I think you said one went to Churchill and one went to...
No, actually three went to the UK, to Churchill.
Okay.
Two went to Army Intelligence, two went to Navy Intelligence, and one was sent to MacArthur in the Far East. And what use he made of that remains unknown. All the records from that period of time have been destroyed. But, you know, the other thing on MacArthur, he had 9 hours advance notice of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
He did?
Yet he left his whole Far East Air Force sitting on the runway, which were totally destroyed by the Japanese attack 9 hours after they attacked.
All right, I've heard all these speculations, but we know then for a fact that General Douglas MacArthur knew about the attack 9 hours before it occurred. Do we know why he was he sleeping? Was he not paying attention? Why would he have done that?
I don't know. It remains an unknown question. He was never held accountable for that. But of course, he did distinguish himself later on in the war in the Pacific, and certainly in the post-war efforts in Japan, and then following that, the Incheon invasion in Korea. But at the initial start, displayed some problems.
You know, Admiral, there's been a lot of speculation that Roosevelt knew and did nothing because this is a speculation. Churchill, of course, wanted the Americans to get into the war because England was desperate for help, and they needed us. They were being decimated.
Oh, yeah, well, exactly.
But Roosevelt was...
You know, in Roosevelt's case, how much he knew is, again, an unknown, because he only received brief summaries and at times only received a verbal briefing from his aide. And for 4 months, as I said in the op-ed, both Marshall and Stark decided between them to deny him 4 months' worth of purple information, called magic, because they didn't trust the people around them. And, of course, they had good reason to not trust him, since we know at that time that the communists had totally infiltrated our government, the State Department, and other agencies which were influencing our foreign policy. And, you know, I might mention that we were actually, before the war, in the summer of 41, we were prepared. We were working. Our ambassador in Japan was Ambassador Joe Gru, and he was working on a truce with the Japanese for their invasion and our involvement in China. And actually, he felt he could have been successful. And when the State Department started leaning towards the development of a truce with Japan, backing the ambassador, the communists... undercover agents went to work. They cast the whole thing was cast in the sunlight of Sergei, who was the lead Soviet agent in Tokyo, had direct access to the Imperial Japanese cabinet. And his message was that you need to look, if you're going to expand the war, you need to look at the British, the Dutch, and the American forces. And the reason he did that, what Joe Stalin was so excited about then, is because in the summer of 41, Hitler broke his pact with Russia and invaded the Soviet Union. And the last thing Joe Stalin wanted was a two-front war. And since Japan was an ally of Germany, they had to make sure that if they did and to expand their current efforts in China, it was against the British, the Dutch, and the Americans, not against the Soviet Union. And that was the whole basis of what was going on then. And the double agents were able to create a situation and confusion to the point that it'd be a great betrayal of our friend and ally Chiang Kai-shek if we signed up and did a truce with Japan. In effect, it was in our great strategic interest to effect that truce because we could have prevented the war, certainly delayed it or whatever, and which would have been in our interest.
You know, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to hear you talk about this because the intrigue of the competing interests and the amount of intelligence and deep, it's not war, it's just not fighting. It's all of this thinking, it's thought, because you've got all of these forces, you know, trying to play against each other, treachery, betrayal, and to figuring out people's motives. And if they're double agents, it really is absolutely overwhelming to the layman. And yet this was your life for 36 years. Admiral, would it be possible for you to stay with me a few more minutes?
Yeah, there's one other thing I want to tell your listeners, so when we can do it when we come back.
Okay, that sounds great. I just before we take this break, I just want to put this in context too. I talk a lot about communism here and about cultural international Marxism, and they're on the march now internationally, no question about it. But at this time in our history, there wasn't the same understanding of communism, I don't think. I don't know if you would agree with that. It wasn't
I do agree with it. And in fact, today you have a lot of misinformation out that it's really the Muslim Brotherhood today has penetrated our government and much deeper than what the communists were able to do in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And the problem with that is they've also compounding that problem is they've made an alliance with the progressives with their Marxist roots. So you have this Muslim Brotherhood progressive cabal working today against our interests. Much it's the same message today that the communists used in the 40 time frame. It's being used again today.
You know, and the other similarity, it seems to me, is that just as I said a few minutes ago, that at this time in our life, in our American life, Americans didn't fully understand the threat of communism. This was before the Cold War, before, you know, Stalin we knew actually how bloody murderous he was and how horrible communism was. I know that some people were in the know. They knew communism was really bad. Many people did not. So I think it kind of is the same as the Muslim Brotherhood now. There are a lot of people who know, it seems to me, like people in the country know, but people in Washington either don't know or just don't want to know. But it is, the parallels are unbelievable, really, that you just mentioned.
And by the way, it's there, and we've watched it play out for the last 10 or 12 years.
All right, well, my guest is Admiral Ace Lyons. Again, he was the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, and we're going to take a break, and when we come back, one of the things, he has something else he wants to add to this. This, we haven't even finished the story on the intrigue that was Pearl Harbor and why people in Washington did not know and what happened to those two men that got blamed and how can that ever be turned around. The other thing is I want to ask Admiral Lyons about his assessment of today's military, especially the Navy, because I think it's important for us to know coming into a new administration. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
This is Steve Tiber, president, co-founder of 8 Days of Hope. 8 Days of Hope was meant to be a one-time trip to Bay St. Louis, Waveland, Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina. And then God got involved. And since then, we have been to 9 different states, rebuilt 1,700 homes, and it's all because we love Jesus. God tells us to love Him and love others, and that's what we do, either through 8 Days of Hope or a new ministry called Hope Reigns. Hope Reigns goes immediately after disaster, a tornado, a flood, a fire, a snowstorm. But what we notice with disasters is right after disaster, there's so many ministry opportunities. We've already been to New York, Illinois, Tennessee, Texas. So if someone's interested in 8 Days of Hope or Hope Reigns, the best place to go is our website, 8daysofhope.com. And even though we might not have an event planned the day you go to the website, if you give us your email address on our website, we'll be able to contact you about future events.
Consider serving the Lord with friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Hi, my name is Alex McFarland. The Word of God in the life of a believer is one of primary and vital importance. The Word of God tells us that we are to read the Scripture, believe and know the Scripture, and share those Scriptures with others. On Exploring the Word, we're helping listeners rise to the challenge of this, to hide God's Word in their heart, and to live a life honoring and fruitful for the author, Jesus Christ.
Exploring the Word, weekday afternoons at 3 Central on AFR Talk.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. Many breathed a sigh of relief when Hillary Clinton lost the presidential election. Christians were rightfully concerned about losing their freedom of religious expression had she been the winner. We've received a divine reprieve for which we are truly grateful. What will we do with this period of grace? We mustn't sit back in apathy and laziness. Instead, we must actively share the gospel message and join others in prayer for our nation that God might grant unto us a repentant heart. Pray for the salvation of President Obama and for President-elect Trump. Bombard the throne room of heaven with prayer that God's Spirit will guide our next president in appointments and policies that will glorify our Lord Jesus Christ. Apathy and laziness, or humility and prayerfulness. God help us, each one of us. This is a Decency Minute, an outreach broadcast of the American Decency Association based in Fremont, Michigan. I'm Bill Johnson.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 75 years ago today, America was murderously attacked by Imperial Japan. The resulting losses of men and materiel were an object lesson in the importance of practicing peace through strength. The Japanese read the failure of this country to maintain a military capable of defending our vital interests, despite the growing threats to them in the Pacific and beyond, as evidence of a lack of national will and an invitation to exploit it. Today, two other Asian powers, Communist China and Putin's Russia, are probably making similar calculations. President Obama's unilateral disarmament and serial acts of appeasement have recklessly encouraged both of these potential, if not actual, adversaries to arrive at similar conclusions. A strategic phone call with Taiwan's president has allowed Donald Trump to begin resetting regional expectations. Now, he needs to rebuild the strength required to secure the peace. This is Frank Affney.
Merry Christmas from American Family Radio and Sandy Rios in the Morning. Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
This is why I'm proud to formally announce today my intention to nominate General James Mad Dog Mattis as the next Secretary of Defense for the United States of America. Jim is a Marine Corps four-star general, the former commander of U.S. Central Command and NATO's Supreme Allied Commander. He led an assault battalion in Operation Desert Storm and commanded the 1st Marine Division in Iraq. He is one of the most effective generals that we've had in many, many decades, and extraordinary leaders of our time who has committed his life to his love for our country. It is now my honor and privilege to welcome to the stage your next Secretary of Defense, General Mad Dog Mattis.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, President-elect, for the confidence that you have shown in me. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm grateful for the opportunity to return to our troops, their families, the civilians of the Department of Defense, because I know how committed they are and devoted they are to the defense of our country, the defense of our Constitution. And with our allies strengthened, with our country strengthened, I look forward to being the civilian leader so long as the Congress gives me the waiver and the Senate votes to consent. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, that was President-elect Donald Trump introducing Mad Dog Mattis, his pick for Secretary of Defense just yesterday. And my guess, this is the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Under the Obama administration, the U.S. military has been gutted. And I don't know that there's any branch of the service that has been gutted more than the United States Navy. My guess is the former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. And Admiral Lyons, I'd really be curious, before we go back to Pearl Harbor, what you think about the appointment of Mattis and what you think about what's happened to the Navy under President Barack Obama.
Well, of course, with General Maddox in there, you know, we've just made a quantum improvement over the last several Secretary of Defense that have been in there promoting President Obama's disastrous fundamental change, which he has imposed on America. And, of course, you know, as I've said many times, that the strategy involved in that change is anti-American, anti-Western, but pro-Islam, pro-Iranian, and pro-Muslim Brotherhood. And I can go into greater detail there. But I want to come back to the Navy here, because the Navy is now down to 273 ships. And for your audience, let me put that number in perspective. That's basically the number of ships I had under my command of the Pacific Fleet. And that's what we have in the entire Navy today. So we are in terrible straits. And, of course, we continue to promote building the wrong type of ships as well. And I'm referring to the Littoral Combat Ship, which is nothing but a failed experiment and should be immediately canceled by the new administration. And, of course, compounding all of the problems we have with our military, I mean, we're winding up with the smallest army since prior to World War II. We're winding up with the smallest navy since prior to World War One, not World War II, World War One. The Air Force is down to the smallest in its history. They're down to 12 wings when they ought to have 18 wings. And, of course, the Marine Corps is suffering the same problem. But, you know, having said all of that, it's been compounded. The problems there are compounded by the social engineering that has been forced on our wonderful military forces. And the first thing we have to do is restore the moral underpinnings of our military forces. In my view, this idea of putting transgenders into the military makes absolutely no sense. It is all of these social engineering factors, none of them contribute to improving our capabilities or readiness. Dr. Paul McHugh, the head psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University, said, speaking about transgenderism, he says it's a mental disorder. It is not a physical problem. It needs understanding and treatment and should never be forced on our military. The same way with putting women in all combat roles makes absolutely no sense. All studies that have been done have shown your readiness and capabilities come down. My view is, and I've always had this position, there are many viable roles for women in the military. Combat is not one of them.
You know, Admiral Lyons, it seems to me, you know, I've been tracking, you don't know, but the military is a special interest to me. We have a lot of military people that listen to this program. But one of the first branches of the military, I remember this from many years ago, that was, it seemed to enter into this social experimentation, was the Navy. And one of the first things I remember hearing was the business of putting women on these submarines with the men for long periods of time, you know, and then when they were having problems with a pregnancy. I mean, it was just, it's an unbelievable, you've got all these young guys and all these young girls.
Let me tell you, in Gulf War One, we had 100 Immaculate Conceptions in the Persian Gulf. I mean, just to give you an example. You know, and the junk you hear about when Secretary Carter tried to sell transgender thing, he was citing, oh, the great success we've had with the removal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell for homosexuals. And, of course, let me tell you what that success is. In 2014, which is the last year we have figures, over 10,000 unwanted male-on-male hits were reported. And your listenership, those are just the reported ones. And I'm sure there are several thousand more involved. So this whole thing that you're going to put, first of all, 18 and 19 years old in close contact aboard a ship, deployed for months at a time, and suddenly nothing's going to happen, you got to be brain dead.
You know, I would think, I'm just assuming, and I know it's true, that for you to have served in the Navy, particularly for 36 years, and to watch your beloved Navy, which really, my husband is a military war buff, and he knows a lot. He's like a walking encyclopedia, and he talks to me about how the Navy, the rich history of all the traditions, and you go to the Naval Academy. Listen, I believe in God, so this isn't a spiritual experience, but it is. It really does feel, it's a wonderful experience. In fact, I noticed in the Navy Chapel, there are all these beautiful scriptures. Who is he that calms the sea? I mean, there was a merger, you know, of faith and service to the country at one time that was unabashed. You must absolutely cringe when you see what's happened to your Navy.
Well, not only to the Navy, but to America itself with the progressive capture of our mainstream media, of academia, what's being taught to our elementary and high school students, and all of this is a tremendous job facing the new administration to turn all of this around. And as I've said, we've got to reinstall the moral underpinnings of our military. It's one of the top priorities.
You know, since you said that, that reminds me of this. You remember after the Soviet Union broke up, there was a huge influx of capitalism, we'll say that. But capitalism just was chaos and ended up being oligarchy and corruption in the former Soviet Union because there was no moral compass, none whatsoever. There wasn't honesty, and so it seems to me, and I wonder if you would, I think you just said this, but let's see if you would agree. It won't be enough to build more ships. It won't be enough to, you know, spend more money on the military to expand. But it really is, it's the moral fiber that has to be regained. It's the purpose, it's the character, the courage, and the commitment really to God and to the country that needs to be reinstated. And the hardware is second. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as part of all of this, you know, one of the things we've got to come to the realization, since our president refuses to identify the enemy, and it was best the enemy that we're fighting today, and which was best described by Erdogan from Turkey when he was prime minister, and he said, Islam is Islam. There are no modifiers. Democracy is the train we ride to achieve our ultimate objective, which is to make Islam the dominant religion throughout the world, under Sharia law. They want to replace our Constitution with Sharia law. So, you have to come to the realization Islam is a totalitarian ideology bent on world domination masquerading as a religion. And until you come to that realization, you will not be successful in defeating that enemy.
All right, we have just a few minutes left. Let's go back to Pearl Harbor. You know, the Japanese, as I understand it, never really believed that America would respond the way they did. They had no clue what was coming next. And many would say that the Islamists don't believe America has character and courage anymore. Do you see a parallel there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've been sabotaged, really, from within. I got to tell your audience, I mean, the Marine Barracks bombing. I had the planes loaded. We were ready to wipe out the Sheikh Abdullah Barracks. We were going to make it look like a plowed cornfield in Kansas. The core group of Hezbollah, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, we're going to wipe them out. And the one who sabotaged that strike more than anybody else was our own Secretary of Defense. I've never been able to figure out who got to him or what got to him, but I've come to the conclusion it was the Iranian Washington lobby group. It's the same thing that we're seeing repeated again. The same thing when they took over our embassy under Carter. I was the director of political and military affairs then for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The chairman called me up and he said, "What can we do?" I said, "I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take Karg Island." And we could have walked in. That was their main oil exporting depot. And I was going to take it with Navy SEALs. And I was going to give them 24 hours to get out of our embassy and release our diplomats, or they were going to have the biggest ashtray they ever saw in the Middle East. So we've had a number of opportunities to change the course of history, but again, through the influence of undesirable undercover agents and so forth, and fellow travelers, we've been sabotaged from within.
Admiral, are you optimistic today? You've seen so many things. And you've had such rich history. You know a lot. You know so much we could talk for hours. Are you in any way optimistic with the election of Donald Trump and with his appointments and the generals that surround him?
I had a big smile on my face when I got up on the morning of the 9th. So, yes, I am optimistic that it's not a question if it's we will take back America.
All right, General. General, I'm going to make you a general this morning, Admiral.
You're excused.
Oh yeah, forgive me, Admiral Lyons. It's just been such a pleasure. It's Admiral James Ace Lyons. If you look him up on online, you can read lots of articles about his life, things that we won't even have time to get to. But his article, "Pearl Harbor, 75 Years On," will be on our Facebook page, and we hope that you will. We'll put it on our Facebook page, and you can read it and share it because it really is intriguing, the inside story of why we did not respond ahead of time to prevent that attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago. Admiral Lyons, thank you. You are a national treasure. Thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
All right.
Best to all your listeners.
Thank you so much, sir. All right, Sandy Rios, enjoying history with you this morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.